We're certainly here, thank you. Any further issues, Mr. Thompson, before we hand over questions for Mr. Clue?
Just on the issue of locking up the land, the balance, have a look at the rules, realise what I said, realise it's actually correct. There was an underlying assumption that you didn't get anything else, that it had been made explicit. It's quite easy to amend the rules to provide for it. Probably a covenant in favour of council that, as part of the within the zone, covered against further buildings anywhere else on the land. Check with Mr. Clue and he's entirely happy that the zone rules be amended to provide such a covenant. So the short answer is yes, it can be offered.
Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Clue answered the question.
Yes, I'm fair.
The old BRA, that seems to be the building restriction area, that seems to be concentrating on. The it's kind of, I struggle to understand how it actually came about, and you just, a couple of times it's been stated that it was without your knowledge and there's no written record of it. You would have to assume that that would be, that was set around, that came into place in order to protect that entrance to Wanaka. There doesn't seem to be any other rationale, surely. So. And just from your perspective, how it evolved and how... Because it's obviously a bone of contention, and I was just wondering...
We were really unaware that it was there until comparatively recently, it's 15 years ago. And I suppose... prior to that, it was just a farm and a satellite farm at that, so our operation was being done from afar, and when things got a bit busier and a bit more professional, perhaps, I realised that it was there and started asking questions, so that was all I can tell you.
And also, following on from the questions, Commissioner Hudson was talking about the track and how it evolved. If you, what you've pointed out or given to consideration of the panel, which is the gulf, the G part of the walkway, it's essentially that's sort of looking at essentially a design line that people are actually using right now. So you go round Mount Iron, and the logical, rather than going down to the dock car park and back up again, it's almost like there's a shortcut that's been built into that.
Yeah. So you're talking from the boundary of the dock estate
to the Allenby
highway and the Allenby toilets.
Yeah. Essentially, people and for years, people have almost been using it just because it looks like the easiest shortcut and it's legitimising, and that's sort of almost how that path up the Mount Iron how it arose. Is because that was a line that's been made, it marked out already. And lots of the paths that you're actually looking at are essentially the same thing.
Now, they have all existing tracks.
Yes. Yeah. It's the, in terms of the... No, I don't really have any further questions. It's all... I mean, a lot of it's taken care of in the expert evidence, which we'll get to. Commend you for your vision. That's the question from
now. Mr. Clue, just a personal curiosity question. Do you still own the farm at Manuetoka?
Our family farm is still there. The farm that my wife and I had, we sold to come here about the time when I started saying that maybe we need to get a bit more hands-on professional about how we manage the Mount Iron property.
Following on from Commissioner Clowes,
question about the VRA. I read the first sentence of your paragraph 16, and is that the VRA that we're talking about? So exceptions were set back on State Highway and Anderson Road to preserve the entrance to Wanaka.
Yes, it is.
And that's my question about what you meant by originally. That was all I had. Any more? Any more? Thank you very much, Mr. Clark.
Thank you.
This is not a sign of things to come.
This makes it quite short. You start reading the paragraph 3.
The threatened environment classification is an abstract classification that does not directly show the vegetation, habitats and species present at a particular site. As the classification is national in scope, local patterns of cover and legal protection may differ from the national pattern. Detailed fieldwork at the Mount Owen site has revealed that the highest ecological values appear in turf, grassland, rock outcrop, and Crosma shrubland habitats rather than in the Kānaka woodland. Ecological values include 4 nationally threatened and 7 nationally at risk taxa, a strong ecological gradient, diverse indigenous plant and invertebrate habitats, and good habitat for common indigenous birds. Many of these values are located outside the notified Mount Owen SNAC. An alternative SNA is proposed, which would include all ecologically significant values but exclude more modified Kānaka woodland within the northern end of the notified Mount Owen SNAC. The alternate SMA would achieve significantly greater protection of ecological values than the notified Mount Owen SNAC. Active management of the alternate SMA would enable maintenance of indigenous biodiversity values at the site, whereas passive management of the notified SMA would not. Ecological management actions, such as control of woody weeds, monitoring, and if warranted, control of pest animals, planting of indigenous trees and shrubs which were formerly present, and encouragement of sensitive use of the site for recreation would enhance the ecological values of the alternate SNA. This would represent a significant improvement and enhancement of ecological values compared to the management of SNAs required under the PDP. Future management of the proposed discard area at the northern end of the notified Mount Owen SNAC would be subject to the Chapter 33 Indigenous Vegetation Clearance Rules and the objectives, policies and rules of the proposed Mount Owen Park Rural Lifestyle Zone. Under the latter, native vegetation located within a lot outside building platforms would not be allowed to be removed except for vehicle access. This level of protection is stronger than provided by the PDP. Kānaka woodland does not represent the original vegetation in this part of the site, which most likely comprised forests dominated by photocarps and broadleaf tree species. Recent purchase of adjacent land at Little Mount Island by Allenby Farms provides excellent potential for indigenous forest restoration. Holistic management of this land, together with the alternate SNA and Mount Lyon Scenic Reserve, would enable Mount Ryan to become a very important ecological area in the local landscape. Mr. Davis states in paragraph 3.2 that he visited the Mount Ryan site on 17th November 2011. In this case, my assumption that no site visit was undertaken is incorrect. However, the reporting remains substandard and, in my opinion, does not represent best practice for the reasons I've outlined in my evidence in chief. The reporting, for example, did not confirm the composition of the vegetation present, as no information is provided on vegetation types or plant species other than Kanaka woodland, and none of the threatened or atlas plant and lizard species present at the site were documented. Mr. Davis quotes out of context from my paragraph 22 of my evidence. In paragraph 22 of my evidence, I state that Kanaka woodland does not represent the original vegetation in this part of the site, which is the discard area at the northern end of the notified Mount Ryan FNAC. In my opinion, quoted out broadly, the forest would have been historic and thus representative vegetation on the deeper soils on the lower slopes of the Mount Ryan site. Mr. Davis appears to believe that because Kanaka was historically present in central Otago, it is representative anywhere where it is currently present. This does not take account of the fact that Kanaka has been able to persist and expand in central Otago because of its resilience to grazing by stock and rabbit and to burn, whereas a suite of browse and fire-sensitive indigenous tree species were almost lost entirely after human settlement. The predictive models that Mr. Davis relies on have the greatest uncertainty in central Otago and a bias towards species that better survive fire, such as Kanaka, Manuka and Kōwhai. More recent research assessing preserved plant remains from dry rock shelters has shown that species such as Rivenwood, Kōwhai, Kōhuhu and Fierce Lancewood were also historically present in central Otago. In my opinion, integrating recent research, observations from the site and observations of exotic tree growth in central Otago, the most likely natural and thus representative vegetation on deeper soils on the lower slopes would have been similar to the dry hardwood forest described by Rogers et al. 2005. This forest would have included species such as Hall's totara, Matai, Ribbonwood, Kōwhai, Fierce Lancewood, Kōhuhu and Broadleaf, which is consistent with my listing of these species as being ecologically appropriate for the 0.4 hectare restoration site shown in attachment 9 of my evidence. I would agree that Kanaka woodland is representative vegetation on thin soils on the upper part of the Mount Ryan site, but on the lower slopes it does not clearly meet the criteria for representativeness, as Mr. Davis states. As Mr. Clue notes in paragraph 21 of his evidence, there was very little carnage to cover on the steeper northern slopes when Allenby purchased the land on Mount Iron, whereas there has subsequently been significant regeneration of carnage in these areas. I also note that Mr. Clue has devoted significant effort to controlling wild and conifers on the site. Without this control effort, it is likely that most of the Allenby farm's land would now be heavily infested with wild and conifers, threatening the persistence of many of the significant ecological values of the site. If future control is not undertaken, the existing conifer saplings will continue to grow and produce seed, ultimately resulting in wild and conifer dominance across the site. In my opinion, Mr. Davis overstates the effects of potential residential development of the discard area on Kawarau gecko and brown creeper. The alternate SNA protects almost all of the known Kawarau gecko locations and the best gecko habitats that were recorded within the site. If residential development of Platform 10 potentially disturbed or killed Kawarau geckos, this would have no effect on persistence of a large Kawarau gecko population at the site. The discard area in which residential development is proposed was specifically delineated to avoid including all significant Kawarau gecko habitats. There is extensive Kanaka woodland habitat available on Mount Ryan for brown creeper, and in my opinion, the amount of clearance of Kanaka woodland required for residential sites would have scarcely no effect on the long-term persistence of brown creeper at Mount Iron. Considerably more Kānaka woodland has been cleared and fragmented outside the Alamy Farms property, yet the brown creeper population persists at Mount Iron. The significance that Mr. Davis attaches to the modified Kānaka woodland in the discard area is misplaced, in my opinion. I do not consider the Kānaka woodland in the discard area to be ecologically significant. A test is that if the entire discard area was cleared, which isn't proposed, it would not result in loss of any of the known significant ecological values within the site. Nevertheless, the Kānaka woodland does have ecological value, for example, as habitat for indigenous forest birds and invertebrates. As such, I believe that any potentially adverse effects on this habitat type that could not be avoided or remedied should be mitigated or offset, and I've suggested options for doing so in paragraph 63 of my evidence. I note that all but one of the conditions suggested by Mr. Davis are being offered by the submitter. With respect to the flammability of indigenous plant species planted within defensible space, that is within 10 metres of residences, only broadleaf is ranked as having low flammability and thus is generally suitable for planting within defensible space. Other practices such as maintenance of lawns, paths, drives and cultivated soils are all practical alternative methods for potentially helping to retard the spread of fire into defensible space. Species such as fierce lancewood, ribbonwood and narrowleaf lace bark have low to moderate flammability and are suitable for planting in defensible space so long as dead material and litter is removed. More than 4 metres is left between tree canopies and trees are not planted within 10 metres of structures. While Mr. Davis believes that broadleaf, pittosporum, fierce lancewood and muffai may be difficult to establish even with irrigation, in my opinion, all have good potential for establishment at the site, so long as they are protected from rabbit browse until sufficiently sized to resist rabbit browse effect. Broadleaf and Kahuhu have both established without assistance elsewhere on the Alamy Farm site. I've been requested to comment from an ecological viewpoint on paragraph 3.30 of Ms. Helen Melsop's rebuttal evidence, where she comments on the predominantly bright or light green foliage of the proposed revegetation species, which she considers would contrast with the dark Cartier of the Kānaka and would likely result in distinct islands of contrasting vegetation. Based upon my statements above about flammability, indigenous tree species within 10 metres of any boundary should be limited to broadleaf, and the other recommended tree species should be planted at least 10 metres from any building. I agree with Ms. Nelsop that the greener foliage of the recommended species would be different from the darker brown colour of the Kānaka, just as the greener foliage of wild and conifer trees would similarly contrast. However, from an ecological point of view, I believe that planting of ecologically appropriate indigenous tree species other than Kānaka would provide a superior outcome. I have seen a copy of the proposed rule which requires retention of native vegetation outside building platforms and vehicle access ways and would prohibit steps being taken to prevent natural native revegetation. I note that the rule does not require or refer to planting of Kānaka and I support that. In my opinion, the future lot owners should be encouraged to plant different native species along the edge of and within the surrounding Kānaka woodland. Over time, that would result in other indigenous species becoming established within and further spreading through the existing Kānaka woodland and, after several decades, would result in a mixed Kānaka broadleaf forest. In the long term, 100 years or more, the existing Kānaka woodland may largely be converted to indigenous forest. The approach I've recommended above would have the following advantages. A, the introduction of indigenous tree species into the Kānaka would reduce the overall flammability of the vegetation surrounding the black building platforms. B, the gradual spread of a range of indigenous trees with different colour, texture and shape would offset any tendency towards the contrasting islands of vegetation of concern to Ms. Nelsop. Over time, a more representative Indigenous forest would develop on the lower slopes, as I've explained above, and provide feed sources for natural colonisation by these tree species of other suitable habitats on Mount Iron. A more diverse forest would create more habitat diversity than the Kānaka woodland and increase the habitat value of the site for Indigenous forest birds and invertebrates. Finally, as a member of the Myrtaceae plant family, Kānaka is susceptible to myrtle rust, which has recently invaded New Zealand. The Ministry of Primary Industries is currently advising people to avoid planting species within the Myrtaceae family. As the tree species I've recommended for planting at Mount Iron are not members of the Myrtaceae, they will not be affected by myrtle rust and provide greater resilience to Indigenous tree cover at the site. I've been requested to provide brief advice about the ecological management plan approved for the Little Mount Iron property under RM 130177, which I understand must be implemented if the house approved under RM 130177 is constructed. I was the author of that plan. The plan includes woody weed control, rabbit and hare control, grassland management, planting to increase biodiversity over the wider site, planting of low flammability species around the proposed building site, and planting guidelines. An implementation strategy and work program was developed for the first 5 years. As the ecological management plan for the Little Mount Iron property contains very similar elements to what is required for the Mount Iron property owned by Allenby Farms, it would be less cumbersome for ecological management of both properties to be managed under a single integrated plan.
If the board just asks any questions, just
One of the things I'm trying to work through is whether or not the area of proposed SNA to be discarded is still significant, or whether it's just not as significant as the replacement area you've identified. So which is it?
As I'll just read out, I don't think it is significant. In my opinion, it's not. In my opinion, a significant natural area that contains significant Indigenous vegetation and significant habitats of Indigenous fauna must have all of those aspects included, and at Mount Iron those would be significant habitats, would be the significant rock outcrops. By significant here I mean larger, more complex rock outcrops that provide good habitat for kauro and gecko. It would be the turf vegetation that supports populations of rare plants on the upper slopes. It would include Kānaka woodland on the upper slopes, where it's more likely to be representative. And so long as it would include the Coprosma shrubland on the southern slope. And so all of those things are the must-haves, and they have to be in the significant area. Now, it's very common when defining a significant area that other vegetation is included into it. And the Kānaka woodland on the lower slopes, which is more modified and not as representative, I would consider that to fit in the other vegetation category.
How important would you rank the discard area?
It's Indigenous vegetation and it provides some habitat for Indigenous forest birds and invertebrates, and as I've stated in my evidence, I think adverse effects on that should be avoided, remedied, mitigated or compensated for. But on its own, it doesn't hold significant value, so on its own it would not be significant in my opinion.
Yeah, so not significant, but important enough that the methods you've proposed are still important to how popular they are. Because to be honest, I was struggling with that. If it wasn't important, why bother with methods to compensate any loss? But you've clarified that it is important, it's just not significant.
Yeah, I mean, district plans often have a similar approach. There's scheduled significant sites, and there's clearance rules for other vegetation, and that's where I see that for.
Thank you. Thank you.
Dr. Roy, just a question following up from your statement about the potential implications of myrtle rot. How much do you know about that? When I ask that, I'm just wondering if you can help us understand what could happen if myrtle rot did take hold in the area in general and got established from that time.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I can't help you very much because there's great uncertainty. Myrtle rust hasn't been in New Zealand before. We know that members of the Myrtaceae are affected, but when myrtle rust has invaded other countries, different species are affected in different ways. And until those effects are kind of expressed here, we don't know which species it will affect the most. So I know that's not very helpful to you.
Based on what you do know, what's the range of potential effects? Can it completely decimate an entire population of a species? Or is there potential for that species to adapt and for some individual plants to survive and, over time to re-establish?
Yeah. Rust fungi are dependent on their host plants for survival, so it's not really in their interest to completely kill a plant. They will tend to weaken them. They commonly affect, that a gardener might notice plants in the Rosaceae family, that's, bitty bits. it's a whole grab bag, actually, roses and all kinds of other things. Blackberries, you often see there's a rust fungus in blackberry populations. So I doubt on its own it would eliminate any species, but in a competitive situation, if it's weakening a species, then another species that's not susceptible to that rust might be more able to outcompete it. So it could have those kind of effects. And you think of something like rata, and which is targeted by possums. Now, if that gets rust as well, I mean, that's potentially a double whammy for that species.
Thank you.
Commissioner Clare. In paragraph 16 and 17 of your evidence you brought about the threatened environment classification, and how it's an abstract classification. Could you expand on that for me a bit? I read that paragraph about four times, and I'm not 100% sure what the thrust of it was.
This could take a little while.
It's okay. No, I'm joking.
The threatened environment classification is based on three kind of databases. Now, one of them is the protected areas database. That's the simplest. It is areas that are legally protected, QE2 covenants,
yes.
Doppler's conservation land. Another one is the land cover database. Now that's where the threatened environment classification gets its percentage cover values, percentage indigenous for each of the environments. So those two aren't too controversial, though the land cover database has some weaknesses. The framework that the threatened environment classification is expressed over is the Land Environments of New Zealand framework. That is a framework that was based on soil, climate and topographical factors that explained reasonably well the distributions of some native trees. Those are broad environmental domains, if you like, and they do not contain any vegetation information. They don't tell you what's there, in other words.
Yep.
So that's where the threatened environment classification is kind of more abstract. It doesn't actually tell you what's there. But the cover classes under the land cover database are very broad. So there's two classes for native forest. One is indigenous forest and one is broadly indigenous hardwoods. Now, most ecologists would represent a whole range of indigenous forest types, but that information isn't present in the threatened environment classification. So you really need site-specific information to properly determine what values are present.
That was a much better explanation. I'm glad I asked the question. And your paragraph 20, essentially, when it says the alternate SNA would achieve significantly greater protection of ecological values than the notified maritime SNA, that's obviously the nub of the whole matter.
Well, I certainly believe that.
So thank you very much for your evidence. It was very helpful. That's all from me.
Thank you. Dr. Lloyd, the summary of paragraph 20, I just wanted to ask you about the would not result in the loss of any known significant ecological values within the site. How have you categorised the site? What is the site for this purpose? Mm.
The site is the Allenby Farms land that we assessed, that we walked over and determined as far as we could where the significant values were located.
So basically the 90 acres that Allenby owns?
Yes, or whatever the area is.
Well, it's not Goldsworth. Told us 90 hectares.
Yeah.
Yes. I was about to say that Mr. Goldsworth assured me that it was 90, the number's right, but it's hectares, not acres.
Correct.
89.99, I think.
Thank you. And we discussed the reviewed at length.
So just to look at that previous question, so were you asking about the second sentence? Would not result in loss of any known significant ecological areas within the site.
Yes.
But that sentence is a test that the entire discard area was cleared. That's not the one here, is that the...
No, but it's within the site is what I was interested in.
Oh, I see. That's my answer. Sorry.
And... is that a normal test? Would you normally look at when deciding what's an SNA? What bits you can chisel off and not affect the values of the whole?
It's certainly my primary filter. The significant site must contain all the significant values. So there's a minimum envelope that includes all those areas, and then other areas can be added on if it's practical to do so.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes we get areas of gorse shrubland or scrub within a significant area, but we don't chisel that out of the area. We include it in there, even though it has quite low ecological value, if it logically and practically is part of the site, we've included it.
Now, I think that you may just have answered my next question. I just want to test this, because I was going to refer to your evidence in chief, which in paragraph 52 says that the discard area does not need to be included. Is that the counterpoint of what you've just told me, that it's effectively, to an ecologist, it's optional?
Yes, and where you draw that line is always going to vary. I mean, there's Carnegie woodland outside the L&B Farms property to the north. Now, that wasn't included in the notified SNA or the one of recommended.
Now, I know this is not your expertise, but I'll test you. We've had a lot of discussion from previous submitters
about identifying outstanding natural landscapes. And the landscape architects talk about a fuzzy line because landscapes are a continuum. Like obviously indigenous vegetation is different in the sense that you could go from a place with some vegetation to exotic grass where there's clearly no ecological values of any moment. But if you have an indigenous cover, are we talking about the same sort of thing? It's a fuzzy line.
Firstly, the exotic grassland, if it's rank grassland, is the habitat of that southern grass skink. So it's not necessarily...
So don't assume that it's nil.
I wouldn't say it's a fuzzy line, but I'd say to some extent it's an arbitrary line, which is kind of the same thing.
Yes, I understand what you mean. Thank you for that clarification. And what in your view will be the ecological effects of the very extensive revegetation program that Halliday's committed to in that northern sector?
I think it has potentially a very large impact, both intrinsically, it's putting the species back there that once would have been there. And we're talking big, long time frames since they were there. Secondly, it'll show people living in the area who see those trees growing, what can be done with native trees in this area. So I think its advocacy value is also quite high.
I'll just get that just clear because you may have misinterpreted the question. I wasn't referring to the revegetation proposed as part of the zoning program. I was talking about the revegetation that Mr. Clue already has underway following for the court proceedings earlier in the year. So yes, I have misunderstood or misled you.
Yes, that's okay.
So I'm going back to the original question.
I struggled to get my preferred outcome into that outcome that the Allenby Farm had, because the council's experts were very focused on replanting of Kānaka, which I don't think is the most ecologically valuable species at the site. So I was focused on trying to get some of those other trees planted in the place of Kānaka. And I think the solution might have been to have a mix of both.
You said might have been, but that wasn't what happened.
I don't even know if I've seen the final outcome of that case.
Okay, well, that's fine. Can't take it any further. We'll leave it there. And when you talk about existing development activities in that northern sector, I know that there are three houses there, and there's a road that we bounced up over following Mr. Clue. Are you referring to anything else?
There are some weedy clearings also in that area, but That covers the main development activities and areas that don't have high ecological value or have low ecological value.
The other question is, you've given us figures about what proportions of coverage that's local. I suppose how did you come up with your definition of what local is?
Completely arbitrary, but you know, within 5 kilometres is reasonable when we're talking about say, forest birds, they're going to be using fragments of habitat within that kind of area. But that example was to illustrate my point that local patterns can be quite different from the national pattern that the threatened environment classification will be.
And my experience discussing SNAs with other ecologists has been that a test that's frequently employed is proportions in an ecological district. Is that relevant? Has that been superseded?
It's relevant, but we have trouble in many cases assessing it, because those proportions should be of each type, but each type isn't mapped reasonably. So it's actually hard to work out how much is remaining of each type. And I've always thought that is also a potentially dangerous threshold, because for a particular type, it'll be in a range of conditions in different parts of the area it occupies. Now, you could fill up your 20% with mediocre examples and then say, oh, well, yes, it's fine to clear the outstanding or examples in good condition. And so I've always been wary of that approach where it's been used alone. So that kind of approach belongs under the rarity category, so how much of something is left. And I've always maintained that under the representativeness criterion, the quality of what is left is also a very relevant factor.
Issue for Mr. Goldsmith to ponder. I think you should consult Mr. Goldsmith, the Shearer litigation, because I think the answer Dr. Lloyd has just given me might be inconsistent with the holding of the High Court. And so you could add to Ms. Hill's list of issues a response. Like, I'm not calling your opinion into question, Dr. Lloyd. You're perfectly entitled to hold your opinion, and sometimes the judges disagree with you. Happens to me all the time. Mr. Hudson, you had a further question?
Dr. Lloyd, something else I should have asked you. You've made reference to other species, plant species that you're recommending your focus on a recommendation for the introduction or reintroduction of broadleaf species, but you've also referred to kowhai. And from what I've observed, there doesn't seem to be much kowhai occurring, whether introduced or naturally, in the wider Wanaka area. And I just wondered if you could comment on that initially.
Looking out the window, there's some great specimens.
Good answer.
But kowhai is a real hammer on, and if you use binoculars as you go down the Kawarau Gorge, you'll see it clinging on to rocks on the other side of the gorge. You know, it certainly is in the landscape.
You were referring to the Kawarau Gorge, but yeah.
Sure. I'm thinking of Central Otago.
So Central Otago, in the broader environment, it does occur, but.
Yes.
Are you able to comment on in the Wanaka area, how far do you go? You were using 5 kilometres as an example of.
Yeah. It's almost easier for me to say where it would have been. And all along the beach there would have been its typical habitat in this area. Coming up the streams, but also in dry forests.
So are you able to just help me understand why it's currently not more prevalent in the local area?
It is among that suite of species that were, like, it wasn't as effective as bad as them, but this whole area was affected by repeated fires after Polynesian colonisation, and that eliminated a lot of the former native woody vegetation almost completely. So I've seen the sketches and paintings that John Buchanan made when he travelled through this area in the 1800s, and there'd be more trees here now than there were then. So those factors were really adverse.
So that's going back quite a long way, and is it farming practice and the like that has resulted in the predation that's resulted in the lack of recurrence since then?
No, I think it's, partly yes, but the seed sources aren't available. That's been the biggest limitation. Because you'll see these things where people plant them, they grow. So, you know, it's not a physical or environmental restriction. It's they haven't been able to get back in. And then for species such as broadleaf, it's very palatable to domestic stock and rabbits as well. So it'll only regenerate in a protected site. And you can find that on the southern slopes of Mount Iron on rock outcrops. Mm.
So, in short, you're confident that revegetation planting will be successful, provided the right management practices are followed?
Yes, certainly it can be successful. I have no doubt of that. Just around some of the LMB Farms houses, you can see ribbon was being planted here, and I don't know what protection that got from rabbits, probably none, but they're doing very well.
Thank you.
One final question for me, Dr. Wood, I should have asked you before. Mr. Goldsmith referred to rabbits. As I understand your evidence, that unlike most places in central Otago, rabbits are not necessarily a bad thing on Mount Iron. That may in fact be a good thing, and keeping the exotic vegetation down. But are the areas of revegetation proposed an exception where there should be rabbit protection?
Oh, absolutely. I think the positive effects of rabbits are maintaining that turf vegetation that those rare native plants can persist in. The negative effects of them are when you're trying to plant a pelican tree and they'll eat it. So there's practical methods of dealing with that, and using tree shelters around your planted trees is the most common one.
Yes, we were puzzled when we did our site visit, and Mr. Clue explained that he made extensive use of car tyres for that reason.
If you stack them high enough, then they would work.
But it was very practical. Any more for you more?
No.
Thank you very much, Dr. Boyd. I appreciate it.
Thank you. So Dr. Boyd has to get back to the meeting. May I have the excuse?
Absolutely. Same chamber, Dr. Boyd.
Thank you.
Most of the Mount Iron landforms that are classified as ONF, both myself and Dr. Merrin agree with that. The bulk of the Mount Iron landform displays a high natural character, largely clad after mature Kanaka with a mix of open grade and with exotic vegetation, which includes conifers, sweetbriar, hawthorn, and some others on parts of the landform. Mount Ida is implicitly surrounded by residential development and is ring-fenced at a variety of elevations by urban and peri-urban development. The proposed Mount Ida Park Rural Lifestyle Zone, which we refer to as the site, is approximately 19.7 hectares in size. Proposal seeks to establish 15 building platforms, BPs, three of which contain existing dwellings, one of which is a substantial dwelling, and so that's supposed to be proposed lot 14, not lot 10, sorry. That's another state there, sir. So proposal seeks to contain the effects within in the proposed building platforms, each being up 1,700 metres squared in size, with three restricted to 1,500 square metres. The effects arising from dwellings will be contained within those platforms. Some minor temporary effects will arise from the formation of access driveways to those building platforms, and I discussed this later in my statement. Lot boundaries will be in effect paper boundaries only, with the existing landscape outside the proposed BPs to remain in its current condition. The main components of the proposal can be summarised as follows. The retention of the existing tanaka to enable the establishment of a controlled lifestyle development within a bush setting. The character of the proposed development will contrast visibly with the contiguous suburbs that exist to the west, east and north site, and in particular the amenity of the Hidden Hills development. The avoidance of large road gaps through road location on mild slope grades utilising existing tracks, with road lighting not allowed. All land outside the BPs and accesses will be fully protected with its existing cover, allowing for the natural existing indigenous vegetation and the spread of indigenous vegetation in those areas. Fencing is restricted to the BPs in the zone boundary. Dwelling sizes were restricted to 500 square metres squared on BPs 1 to 9 and 13 to 15 and 275 metres squared on BPs 10, 11, 12, with building heights restricted to 4.5 metres in all lots except lots 10, 11 and 12, where heights are restricted to 3.8 metres. I do note that the height of 4.5 metres coincides roughly with the average height of Tanaka after maturity. The other selective and specific controls in regards to colour and building form, with all roofs and colour steel iron sand, which is very dark grey, or similar. Dwelling owners require to undertake 400 square metres of indigenous planting within each BP, and any exotic plant is not to exceed 1 metre high in height at full maturity. The proposed location of the 15 BPs can be summarised as follows. Proposed BPs 1 to 9 and 14-15 are located in the lower elevations and, when viewed from those places shown in the photographs of my original attachments, sit within or are viewed behind an existing framework of rural residential and residential development. Proposed BPs 12 and 13 on the coastline and mid-level elevations on the western side, on western end of the site are hidden from wider views by existing landform vegetation. And proposed BPs 10, 11, 12 are located on the upper elevations of the site. Our specific restrictive rules will apply to dwellings in those, so three BPs, with regard to dwelling heights and roof pitch. Dwellings on the proposed BPs 1 to 9...
Before we move on, sorry, can you just clarify, you've got 12 there listed twice, and the bullet points above. Mm. Are we going with mid-level or upper?
Sorry, I have got them twice. No, upper, sorry.
Upper, okay, thank you.
Yep.
So 12 and upper?
Yes, sorry about that. Yes, out of the second bullet point, remove 12 and put it into, and it should stay in the third bullet point, from my apologies, that in the third bullet point should have three BPs. Dwellings on the proposed BPs 1 to 9 and 15 are located behind landform and within pockets of open land, with a foreground of visible residential dwellings from western and northern views. The continuous building controls with regards to height and colour in particular will ensure that these dwellings will be visually absorbed into the receiving landscape. And this in contrast to the pattern of visible colour and form of existing residential dwellings within those views. Dwellings on proposed BPs 10, 11, 12 are subject to specific restrictive controls to ensure that the dwellings are below skyline from views and will be difficult to perceive. They will be small, low, darkly coloured dwellings within a heavily vegetated framework of existing kānaka. A dwelling on BP 13 will be approximately 35 metres from the track, set in an open area flanked by mature kānaka. Walkers at this position are at the end, hold the beginning of their track experience, and establish residential development, the Hidden Hills development, is located close by and is visible. Lot 14 contains an established homestead with established gardens and amenity. Within the site boundary, the BPs are located within distinct minor landforms on the site. These landforms can be described as BPs 1, 2 and 14 are located on existing lower terrace, which is east of Bevan Place. BPs 3 to 9 and 15 are located on the hill flank and located within a series of undulating contours within largely open grass areas and within the existing kānaka framework. And just to point out that, of course, BPs 7 and 9 already have dwellings on them. BPs 10 and 11 are located on the upper portion of the site within areas largely covered by kānaka. BPs 12 and 13 are located on the eastern portion of the site within a valley extending southeast and rising from the south end of Hidden Hills Road. The outcome of these distinct groups of dwellings in regards to visibility is that views of these proposed groups of dwellings are separate and distinct, with no single public viewpoint aside from that western view shown on my attachment D, where one is able to discern more than, it should have five in it, which is really important. Five dwellings in any given view. On my attachment D, the majority of those lots will only have a sliver of roof, which is potentially visible, and I refer to my original attachments. Those attachments clearly show the lack of visibility of the BP platforms and the minimising of possible adverse cumulative effects on the wider landscape values. I've recommended that the building footprint in lot 12 be restricted to 275 metres square for reasons I've outlined for BPs 10 and 11. I consider the site to be at the edge of the ONF, and given its proximity to existing residential development and consequently the effects on landscape quality and character, those are acceptable. In general, the development south of Albury Road and at Hidden Hills exhibits a high degree of human influence in the form of dwellings with exotic plantings and both established, mature and recent. The general pattern of residential development flanks the western and northern portions of the proposed development, providing an established foreground to the development. From northern views, that existing development occupies a substantial portion of the visible northern flanks of the hillside, covering the third to lower half of that visible land, of those visible landform flanks. The upper portion of that landform remains largely covered in kānaka, with smaller clearings visible, but with little evidence of human influence. The cumulative effects arising from the development are proposed on the site and will exhibit a minor change to the existing amenity of that land. That landscape is relatively unique. Now, that's an ONF flanked and abutted by residential development. And in my opinion, that character will remain substantially intact. Some notes of Helen Melsop's rebuttal evidence. Paragraph 3.23, first paragraph. I agree that the establishment of the proposed indigenous vegetation will require care and attention. However, I note that on similar vegetation on the existing Hidden Hills development has grown well. And from my experience in overseeing planting in this area, and that's all the North Lake work we've done recently, which has grown pretty well, I can confirm that proposed plantings, with appropriate mulching and care, will establish well on the site. All the indigenous plantings are really close to the dwelling and can be easily cared for with irrigation and weeding until established. exotic planting, and I just want to clarify this. The intention of the controls is to require substantial indigenous plantings by way of the requirement to perform at least 3 of indigenous plantings. My original recommendation for exotic plantings was for a small vegetable herb garden of 20 metres only, which we've actually done on other fronts, but not in South Island, up north. This has been amended following discussion to allow for exotic plantings to be undertaken but not to exceed 1 metre at maturity, and I'm satisfied with this. I agree with that parts of Mount Hyam would be highly sensitive to cumulative effects. This proposal proposes dwellings that are consistently darker in colour and lower than surrounding existing dwellings in the vicinity. From any given viewpoint, a maximum of 3 to 4, our dwellings will be potentially visible, albeit recessively coloured, with the bulk of the dwellings and similar elevations to existing residential housing from public views. The wider visible character of the northern flanks of Mount Hyam will still be largely defined by the current existing residential development, with the proposed development a minor addition to that pattern, and that's albeit a less visible one. In general, the wider visual amenity values of the northern flanks will remain intact. Now, paragraph 3.30. I acknowledge that the proposed indigenous plantings will differ in hue and colour from the surrounding Kānaka forest. These colours, however, will be minimal areas of colour within the wider colour pattern, which is dominated by Kānaka. The indigenous plantings other than Kānaka, that is located around many established residential dwellings at Hidden Hills and cannot be readily detected, and that's readily detected for public views.
Now, Mr. Baxter, one point of clarification. You amended your summary paragraph 4, and I was distracted, so I didn't write that number down. Is that 14?
Yes, yes.
And is that the third existing building?
That's Mr. and Mrs. Clue's house, yes, not 14.
Thank
you. Our existing dwellings are on 7, 9, and 14.
In the road. Sure. One of the things that always takes me about this district's ONS is that on a very clear starry night the features are often blacker than the sky and have a real silhouette effect. Now, on the northern side of Mount Hyam doesn't have that to the extent that some other pure ONS have. But I am quite interested in understanding the extent to which, as much as possible, any additional development doesn't worsen the existing nighttime environment. Now, in your evidence in chief, you talk about the nighttime environment, and I appreciate your conclusions, but first and foremost, is it your view, based on all the work you've done identifying the sites, that in the evening, people would readily be able to see lights inside new houses?
Yes, they'll receive them. They pointed out you're going to see a light. If the light's on, we'll see it. If the light cannot, you'll see a light on a hill over there. But one of the recommendations, of course, was to keep street lights out. But yes, you'll see house lights. Yeah, that's helpful.
I was interested in your summary comment that I'm just going to find now, to the effect that the new dwellings will effectively not be any higher than existing dwellings.
Okay,
I'm just trying to find where you said that. You said the bulk of the dwellings are similar elevations to existing residential housing from public views. That was in your summary paragraph. So one of the things I haven't quite got my head around, to be fair, is in relation to all the existing housing, where these platforms. So I appreciate that the lower ones seem to be, for that any contestation, not higher than existing houses, but I'm trying to understand, if I look at Mount Hyam from the north, how much higher up that slope it's going to look like houses are going.
Yeah. On a, from a pure elevation point of view, like meters above sea level, the highest ones aren't quite as high as the dwellings on, as the highest ones on 30 Hill. If you follow the context, I'll just not put things right away.
Yeah. That's helpful. Thank you. And in response to Ms. Melsoff, my last question, this is that,
somewhere
about the chair's instruction.
Yes, indeed. Clearly a chocolate fish.
sorry, back to it. This question of the lighter coloured vegetation going around the houses for things like fire safety and so on, and you've given your view of the overall effect of that, but do you think that those patches of the brighter vegetation would reinforce to viewers that there were houses in the landform, or do you think they would effectively just, as can be seen from some other parts of the district, just patches of different coloured vegetation?
Well, I just don't think we're going to see them. I mean, this is a... I don't know if you've got my original attachment.
I do.
By.
Yep.
Attachment H is an interesting one.
Yep.
And you can see the conifers, the eucalypts, the golden elms. See what's going, what we're talking in there. That's what we want to avoid, is that you see right in the middle. Yeah, and we wish to avoid that. And this is a discussion I've often had with council officers, even protecting on green lawns or golf courses within the rural environment. But, you know, I always challenge people coming down the zigzag at on the Crown Range to point out the vivid green lawns, which are contrasted with the paddock, you know, the paddock beside, they're the same colour. What we have here is, it's, I'm not worried about those little bits of green because you just won't see them. I'm more interested in keeping out that larger contrast between it, the form of exotic tree and the Kanaka cover. That doesn't worry me.
Yeah, I said it was my last question, but I thought another one. just reflecting on the work you've done, and I think, you know, we've got quite a while now, how much wiggle room do you think remains on the site beyond the building platforms and development limitations you've identified? Specifically, should development beyond what you've identified be outright prohibited as a means of safeguarding all the natural qualities, or do you think someone smarter than all of us could find a way through a resource consent to justify some additional development in there?
I'm not sure how what the provisions of the zone allow for any future development. I can't assure you when I started this journey with Mr. and Mrs. Clue, their intention was for more lots than this, and I had to beat them into shape, and we ended up with a lot less than they wanted because I was starting to have problems with human effects issues and things like that. So what we have here is what I think is a manageable size and balance with the existing landscape amenity.
If, through whatever process of evaluating things going forward, we came to the view where we had, let's just say, comfort with where you've got to, but had serious reservations about anything beyond that, would you have any opposition for us effectively saying the line is nothing further than Mr. Baxter's identified?
No, well, that's pretty much in line with the human effects argument that I've come to.
Yep. Okay, thanks for that. And good on you for saying that with the quiet behind you.
I'm not looking over my shoulder, but you know, I mean.
He hasn't taken it off yet. So far, so good.
Commissioner Hudson.
Yes, please. Good afternoon, Mr. Baxter. First of all, could you clarify for me in your summary statement, in paragraph 12, where you corrected your comment in the third line, where you said one day would discern, and I think we said no more than five dwellings at any given view. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
So you then went on to say in paragraph 18, from any given viewpoint, a maximum of 3 to 4 will be potentially visible.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry. I should clarify that to 3 to 5. And by way of example...
So you're not saying 3 to 5?
Yes. So my apologies. Yeah. I mean, where I've got arrows in some of my attachments on here, because we did have a poll in the centre of each one which was put up, so we get to go around and assess them all.
The poll is still there, so yes, we have seen.
Oh, they are still there?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Okay.
Very helpful.
Yeah, yeah. But there are polls that you can't see, but I've still got arrows down to them. So they haven't actually clarified which ones you can and cannot see on here, but you're looking at.
Well, we're talking about polls.
Yes.
Did you mind if I have to say, Mr. Baxter, one thing that struck me during our site visit, because we pulled up at North Lake, was how visible some of the poles were, how far they stuck out above the Kāreka. And you don't get a sense of that in the diagrams because you've got like an arrow pointing downwards.
Mm.
You said that the proposed height limits are the height of mature Kāreka. Is it as simple as the Manuka's not mature yet?
No. They were 5.5 metre poles. We looked at them and said we can't have buildings that height, so those were the ones I recommended. That's 9 and 10 on attachment G, and I know exactly what you're looking at. Those are the ones for that reason. They're 3.8 metres high. So we looked at the poles. They were above the skyline. I wanted to keep them down, but below Kāreka, and that was our reason for dropping the height poles on those ones that were in skyline. Yeah. So the poles you're looking at are all 5.5 metres, they're not. Yes, they're all 5.5.
And so what you see is not what you get?
Well, take a metre and a half or so.
Yes,
on.
Yeah. So which ones have you reduced beyond the centre?
10 and 11. It's on attachment G. A building platforms 10, 11 and 12 have been reduced down in recommendation to 3.8 metres, and the ones that you see on Skyline still at 5.5 metres are the ones shown on my attachment sheet.
Thank you.
I'd like to go back to your attachment D, to your evidence in chief, where you had identified 3.7 building platforms on that particular photograph. So can you just help me understand? If you've got 7 building platforms and you're saying that they won't all be visible from that particular viewpoint.
And it should also be noted at this point that 3 of those building platforms are called building
platforms. Yeah, I just noticed that myself. That's the viewpoint of the year. Yeah, the right-hand BP3, and my problem is that I think we moved the B. I may have to... I know that there's no more, I mean, there are some of these arrows in here that indicate we're dwelling as well, we couldn't see a pole. I really have to check that, and that's a slip on my, I mean, I know that we can't see more than 5 because some of those are up below the Kāreka level. So, this is a drafting error.
I think we do need to have that clarified.
Yes, and I think it's important.
Because if you're talking about them being below the Kāreka level, well, if some Kāreka clearance was to occur, then they may be visible.
No, those ones you see there, I know, are all the ones that are located in those open areas. They're not lots 10 and 11. Lots 10 and 11 are around that ridge. Skyline on there. So all those ones in there, within those areas, if we look at my attachment A, those are the ones which are, there's very little Kāreka to be taken out for the purpose of construction on my attachment A. They're largely open areas. There is Kāreka to come out, but...
I wonder if, for the sake of good order, Mr. Goldsmith, is it better
have a replacement appendix D.
I can pop out and check that out. It's here this afternoon.
We'll leave scaling time scales with Mr. Goldsmith at the end of the day, but I think we need to, as you say, we need to have something we can rely on without having written amendments all over the commission.
Now, I'm still referring to attachment D and acknowledging that any photograph represents a fixed viewpoint, and we don't really see anything in the landscape quite like that. You've talked about the relationship of these building platforms as being no higher than Hidden Hills. But Hidden Hills is to the left in this picture, isn't it? So what I wanted to ask you is, in terms of cumulative effect, are we not also needing to consider that the visual effect is not only the sort of linear extension of buildings, but the, what appears to me, anyway, from my own observation, a higher elevation above the existing. So Mount Iron, at that point, I should put it to you, is that a fairly discrete landform with little Mount Iron off to the side? Should we be considering only Iron, or do we need to, in the terms of the landscape assessment, consider what's already on Little Mount Iron?
That can get complicated. Can I just say where we, when we spent the day driving around, the views that we selected are always the views that we think is the most visible from. And that's important, you know. To be honest, from this view, I think Little Mount Iron almost from the western flanks, Little Mount Iron is almost distinctly different. But we're looking at those long run-out northern toe slopes of Mount Iron. And Little Mount Iron turns up again round by Hidden Hills. It's a different feature, I think. That's the reason I think that I think it's really important here when I look through the design controls, and as I can make comment on them, not one of those houses on Hidden Hills would pass these design controls. They'd all be non-compliant. Neither colour or height.
I think what you're saying, what's on Little Mount Iron is there. You know, nothing is going to change what's there. And do understand that the much more rigorous controls that are proposed here would mean that the effects are different. But what I wanted to understand is, first of all, are we looking at the effects on something that at the moment has nothing on it that's visible at those higher elevations?
I agree partly with it because it has nothing on it. And in the context certainly of these western views around the high school fence there, you're coming round onto that flank. There's nothing there at the moment. If we look at it in the context of the Albury Road views, then we can say there is something already because all the houses in the foreground that become in the same height. There is nothing there at the moment, but that's the nature of subdivision. We start with nothing.
In that case, notwithstanding the proposed rules, I think you have acknowledged that the presence of dwellings will be visible. You said that up to five.
Potentially visible. They can be pretty hard to see. There are one or two buildings up at Hidden Hills which are close to these colours here, which you just can't see, you know. So it's about colour is the number one. But they will be potentially visible if they're pointed out.
So if you if they can be seen, or if a single dwelling in that setting can be seen, what is your opinion about the overall effect on the landscape? Again, looking mostly at this particular vantage point.
Given the scale of the mountain landscape, I think that the effects will be minimal, and that's been my evidence. Yeah.
What I'd really like to understand is whether even one dwelling is going to create, tip the balance. I mean, you said you struggle with cumulative effects, and your advice to your client was that the number originally envisaged would not have been acceptable. So, is it fair to say that if there is some impact from a dwelling, that is going to tip the balance or not tip the balance?
I don't think one dwelling is ever going to tip the balance. The hard question is here is keeping an objective approach to how many dwellings will tip the cumulative balance. And I think I've tried to endeavour here to select the correct positions, the correct lightness, with the correct controls, with the appropriate controls, which meets the thresholds which I'm required to assess. So there could be people out there that think one may be too many, there could be people out there that I don't mind, this is 50, our job is to try and find the balance and meet the district now.
Did you consider the effects of reflection off glass?
Sorry, of that?
Reflection off the glazing.
Yes, well that's why one of the rules I think they put in here when any glazing was
2.8,
but I want a veranda over it too, like an island, okay. So we don't have the flat modern case, and that stops the
That's to help it. Yeah. You've talked about the height of, or that Kanaka will reach a height of 5.5 at maturity.
4.5
at maturity. I just wanted to understand what you expected the maturity of the Kanaka to be. Well, how long is it going to take to get to what you defined as the mature?
Well, I mean, there's a distant Kanaka which is about that sort of size, 3.5 to 5. The ones that we planted over at North Lake Drive, where they spent about 6 months depends on that job, and in that front driveway going up, they've grown 2.5 metres in 2 summers, with good irrigation and mulching. Yeah, they've really grown well if you look after them. So to get that height, Linton probably watched them. Clue could probably say how long he's watched them to get that height. Naturally, I can say with the assistance of irrigation and good care and mulching, 5, 6, 7 years. Now, they're pretty fast growers if they're looked after.
Yes. Now, Dr. Roy was talking about the benefits of introducing a wider range of major plant species into the existing Kanaka. So not just around the house site, but actually spread it out a bit more. Has that been given any consideration by you or Mr. White?
I think it's a suggestion, but I don't think it's been, I'm not sure it's been adopted. The management plan, I've been focusing on the effects of the actual around it, within the building platforms themselves. So.
In your opinion, would that be of landscape benefit as well as ecological benefit to actually do some revegetation within the wider areas rather than just around the house?
I think that any revegetation would be helpful. It's not necessary for the mitigation of the houses we're talking about there, because we've got that contained within the building platforms, but from that point of view, any planting's a plus.
Right.
I think that's all. Thank you very much. Mr. McLeod? Yep. I wonder if I can take you back to attachment D again, which I know we're going to replace. I know it may have a few hiccups on it. But this would, and I take some comfort in Mr. Clue's suggestion that there be a covenant on the remainder of the land. But if you imagine my concern about that building restriction area on that photograph, which is the grassed part, you can see how if you transferred those house sites to the grass part, there'd be a concern. And from your landscape perspective, there's nothing there to hinder that.
Now, they was most of you can't see the clearings in those photos. They're down under the arrows, which you probably know. But they were selected for the reason that they were clear and they had Kanaka to the west of them. Yeah, substantial Kanaka. So there was an advantage in that in terms of existing mitigation.
Yeah. I think there's actually more of a question for Mr. Goldsmith potentially is that you suggested that there was a cabin on the remainder of the land. Did that include that building restriction area at the start of this session? There was potentially amended rules to cabinet the remainder of the land from further development. Was that my understanding?
Yes.
Which would include that building restriction area?
Yes.
That was all. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Actually, no, for me, one more.
Possibly.
You sure? There was some discussion earlier on about the arrival to Wanaka and when it transfers from a rural setting to a town setting. From a landscape perspective, I would value your input.
Well, it's not part of my evidence here, but I am working on three parts and I know where the roundabout probably going further up the road. And Queenstown, when you put a roundabout in, that's the start, you know, that's where you first hit the town. So I haven't looked closely yet. I do know that, I think from what I understand, is that big avenue of trees in there is actually on the Clues land as well, so the land extends quite a way out. But I haven't been based on, it's not a discussion I've had with this.
Yeah, no, that's fine. In that case, I won't put you on the spot any further.
Thanks. The only thing I had there first, you call the northern flanks of Mount Iron relatively unique. I'm sure you can say relatively unique, might be a contradiction in terms. What do you mean? Can you expand on that?
Well, it's the downstream part of the Roche Mokonei, really, isn't it? You know, that landform formed by a glacier, which is always a rugged, rough bit, and coming to Wanaka, we've got that big front gap, that wall of rock, that wall of hill, and then everything's relatively soft around here. And its uniqueness was that rugged landform coming into Wanaka. That's unique in contrast in terms to the wider rolling glacier landscape of Wanaka Hawea catchment. Does that answer your question? That contrast.
The contrast between the upstream and the downstream side.
Yes.
That is, do I have any more people? Thank you very much, Mr. Baxter.
Thank you.
At 28 minutes past 3, we'll adjourn for 15 minutes. We'll be back at 4:30.
Can you excuse me?
Can indeed.
Thank you.